All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It's Anti-War Radio, and it's Patriots Day, April 19th, 2011. We're going to go ahead and start the show with our first guest. It's Jesse Trenadu. He's a lawyer from Utah. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Jesse?
Fine, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here, and I'm going to go ahead and give them the short version here real quick to start us off, and you correct me if I'm wrong or anything like that. Make sure we're straight to start off here. Jesse's brother, Kenneth, in 1995, was the spitting image of somebody else, and he was arrested. He had a probation violation, I think, was arrested crossing the Mexican border and had the wrong dragon tattoo, the wrong red hair, the wrong pickup truck, and was just wrong place, wrong time. He was nabbed by the feds, and they were convinced that he was someone else, someone named Richard Guthrie. And apparently because he wouldn't admit that he was this Guthrie character, Kenneth Trenadu was tortured to death in a federal prison cell in the summer of 1995. And ever since then, Jesse has been waging a battle for truth and justice in the matter of the murder of his brother. And in pursuing this, he has found himself up to his eyeballs in the story of the Oklahoma City bombing. Is that right? And then could you explain how it was that you somehow connected the story of your brother's death with the Oklahoma City bombing, Jesse?
Well, that's basically the story, Scott. He, Kenny had a no-beer-drinking condition on his probation. And, of course, we fought that. You know, the probation officer didn't agree that he should drink beer, and we lost it. And so he told his probation officer, my brother worked construction in Southern California, that he was going to drink beer, and they could come and get him if they wanted to. Well, they never did, obviously, because you don't send people back to prison for drinking beer. What happened is he came across the border, as you say, and he was picked up, sent to Oklahoma City. He arrived there on Friday, the 18th of April, 1995. I spoke with him on Saturday, the 19th. It was August of 1995. On August 19th, 1995, I talked to him, and we would get ready for his probation hearing. And he supposedly committed suicide the night of August 20th, 1995. It took us a week to get his body home. Meanwhile, the federal government had tried at least twice to have him cremated. And when we did receive his body home, he was made up heavily so you couldn't see his wounds. And we removed the makeup, and his head had been smashed in three places to the skull. He was beaten front to back, head to toe, and his throat was cut. And the government said that he had committed suicide by hanging. And at the time, we just never had a motive. And the harder we pressed the government, especially the FBI, for the truth, the more things went amiss. The crime scene photographs disappeared. All the logbooks that would have shown my brothers, who had access to my brother, disappeared. If they didn't disappear, the pages from the logbooks disappeared. The surveillance cameras malfunctioned. He was found in bloodstained clothing. And when his body's turned over to the medical examiner 2 hours later, the clothing had disappeared. Where he died was considered a crime scene, yet the FBI and the federal government had it cleaned and painted. It wouldn't allow the medical examiner in to examine the death scene. All these things were happening, and we could never figure out why. And then, I think it was December of 1995 or January 1996, I received an anonymous call, and this was back before you had caller ID on telephones and things like we have today, who said that your brother was killed by the FBI. It was an interrogation that went bad. It was a case of mistaken identity. He fit the profile of a member of a group of people who were anti-government and robbing banks to get money to attack the federal government. And, of course, I just blew that off as a nut case calling. And then in June of 1996, I read an article in the Los Angeles Times about a fellow named Richard Lee Guthrie, who had been a member of a group called the Midwest Bank Robbers, who had supposedly hanged himself while in federal custody the day before he said he was going to give an interview to the Los Angeles Times that would blow the lid off the Oklahoma City bombing. And they didn't have a picture of Guthrie, and I just read the story and just didn't pay much attention to it. And then shortly before he was executed, I got a message from Tim McVeigh, who told me that when I saw your brother's photograph and heard what happened to him, I want you to know that he was probably killed by the FBI because they thought he was Richard Lee Guthrie. And then I started to inquire about Guthrie, but what really pulled it together for me was J.D. Cash, who's now dead, but he was a reporter, a dogged reporter from a little paper in eastern Oklahoma, who had followed the bombing from the day it happened until he died. He had family killed and injured in the building in the bomb blast, and friends who had been killed and injured in the blast. And I received a call one day, I think it was about 2003, 2004, from J.D. Cash. And he said, I want to talk to you about your brother. And I said, well, he introduced himself. And then he said, describe your brother. I said, well, he was about 5'8", 5'9", dark complected, muscular. J.D. said, well, where was he when he was arrested? And I said he was coming across the border from Mexico. His wife was Mexican-American. She's an American citizen, but he'd been down to visit her family across the border from San Diego. And he said, well, what was he driving? And I said he was driving a 1986 Chevrolet pickup truck, which belonged to his friend. And he said to me, J.D. did he have any tattoos? And I said, yeah, Kenny had a tattoo. And J.D. said, where? I said, he had a dragon tattoo. And J.D. said, where? And I said, on his left forearm. And then J.D. says, are you sitting down? I said, yeah, I'm sitting down. And he said, let me tell you about this. He said, the largest manhunt in American history was for John Doe 2, and it was taking place at the time your brother was arrested. He said, this is the description the FBI put out of John Doe 2. White male, dark complected, 5'8" to 5'9", a heavily muscular, heavy build, believed to be in Canada or Mexico, driving a mid-1980s Chevrolet pickup truck, dragon tattoo, left forearm. And he said the other person who matched that description was Richard Lee Guthrie. And so what happened is I started out, now I had a motive as to why my brother was murdered and tortured for information he didn't have. And then I started to pursue that, and every trail I went down, every lead I followed, took me back to the Oklahoma City bombing.
All right, now we're approaching the break here. We just have 1 minute, so I want to sum up. Our guest is Jesse Trenadue. He's a lawyer from Utah, and his brother Kenneth was tortured to death by federal government employees in his prison cell in August of 1995. In what was apparently a case of mistaken identity, they thought he was Richard Lee Guthrie, who turns out knew Timothy McVeigh and the Aryan Republican Army bank robbery ring of the early 1990s, early to mid-1990s. And ever since then, Jesse's fought this legal battle to get to the truth about what happened to his brother and accountability and responsibility for those who murdered his brother. And along the way, he has come up with so many documents and so many secrets and exposed such a cover-up. One more note as we go out to this break. At ScottHortonShow.com, you can find many interviews of J.D. Cash, the great reporter he referred to. We'll be right back after this. It's Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and on the line is Jesse Trenadue. He's a lawyer in Salt Lake City, Utah. And the feds murdered his brother, Kenneth. And they did so because they thought he was Richard Lee Guthrie, friend of McVeigh, and apparent participant in the Oklahoma City bombing. I urge you to check out the website kennethtrentadue.com for more information. And there's a lot of great journalism about this, not least of which from the great J.D. Cash at the McCurtain County Gazette. the late J.D. Cash, old friend of both of ours, Jesse. All right, so now here's the thing. We've got a little more than 10 minutes here. We can't tell them everything, but I was hoping you could hit the highlights of, you know, some of what's been found out. Of course, there's a lot of information coming out about the Oklahoma City bombing cover-up before you ever got clued into this thing by J.D. Cash and by a letter from Timothy McVeigh that you described earlier. But now you've come out and, I mean, every once in a while I get PDF files of these FBI documents that you've succeeded in having the courts in Utah wrangle out of them and so forth, the Secret Service timelines and depositions of ATF informant handlers and all kinds of things, witness statements and 302s of every description. And so I was wondering if maybe you could just, you know, touch on some of the most important things to get people's interest piqued and let them know where they can go learn about this kind of thing. What is the basic narrative as you've been able to figure it out so far? What really happened at the Oklahoma City bombing?
Well, I didn't get a letter from McVeigh. It was to a third party that associated with him.
Oh,
he sent it out to me. And I started to press then the FBI for their links to the bombing, and I focused on a white supremacist paramilitary compound in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City. And it turns out, and it's not me making this up, and I think you'll tell your audience, what I'm about to tell your audience is, comes from FBI documents.
Hey, and I have them. I have a whole folder called Trinidad Files, and it's full.
The FBI, after Waco and Ruby Ridge, was under tremendous pressure from Congress and the media and American people for their screw-ups. Somewhere in that period of time, I think they put together this idea of a sting operation, focusing on the militia, the neo-Nazi movement, to infiltrate them with agents and provocateurs to get them riled up so that they would plan some kind of attack on the federal government. And I don't know whether they intended to stop it and be heroes or to let it go through. And in my mind, I wrestled with that question, and I don't have an answer. But the fact is, they had at least four or five informants in with Timothy McVeigh. They knew, the FBI knew, at least 4 months before April 19, 1995, when the bomb went off, that the Murrow Building was going to be destroyed. And they didn't stop it. And they have fought me incredibly hard to keep from having these documents turned over. And I sued in federal court under the Freedom of Information Act to obtain these records. And none of them are older than the afternoon of April 19, 1995. And so I go back to the judge, the federal judge, and say, Your Honor, it's inconceivable that this sting operation would have sprung to life 2 hours after the bomb went off. It had to be there in existence beforehand. And he agreed, and he said I had an order from the court that I could go take Terry Nichols' deposition, because Nichols wanted to tell the whole story, who was involved, why it was done. And the FBI went to a higher court, a court of appeals, and had that order set aside, basically out of fear of what Nichols would say. The big fight now, and it'll happen on May 11th, is over the surveillance cameras that were on the Murrow Building. The external cameras. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the Murrow cameras, videotapes, and the cameras from the other buildings on the route McVeigh would have taken to deliver the bomb that morning. And these were the other cameras on the exterior of the buildings along the road that McVeigh would have driven to take that truck, the Ryder truck bomb, to the Murrow Building. I received 26 tapes. These tapes go blank at various times between 8:58 on the morning of April 19th and 9:02 on the morning of April 19th when the bomb went off. So as McVeigh was driving by a particular building, the tape goes blank for 10 or 15 seconds. And then further down the road, the tape on that building will go blank for a few seconds as McVeigh would have passed. And the FBI claims that all these tapes were being recycled or changed, and that's why they're blank at these crucial times. But they didn't give me the Murrow tapes. And I have an affidavit from an Oklahoma City police officer who arrived on scene just after the bomb went off. he's desperately, and other people are desperately trying to pull people out of the rubble to save their lives. Literally at gunpoint almost, the FBI orders them out of the building, and he watches as the agents take the cameras down from the Murrow building. And then the rescue operation is allowed to proceed after that's done.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there was a report on Channel 4, which, you know, Jaina Davis from NBC Channel 4 in Oklahoma, she went down that entire American Enterprise Institute, Judith Miller, Iraq Did It rabbit hole thing there. But there was some good work at the very beginning before they tried to blame it on Saddam Hussein, of all people. One of them had, and I believe there was an L.A. Times reporter who was one of the sources for the story. There were two sources for the story who said they had seen some of these videotapes, that they showed two men get out of the truck, that it was not McVeigh, but John Doe 2 who goes to the back of the truck and apparently lights the fuse or sets the timer or whatever it is. And then the bomb goes off. And, you know, the story came out way back then, and they said, well, the government says they'll show us the video once we get to trial. But, of course, all they showed us was one still photo from one of the video cameras of the truck at a red light, and you can't see who's in it at all.
So, and I was leaked a document, a federal government document, that says the surveillance cameras show the bomb detonating 3 minutes and 6 seconds after the suspects exited the vehicle.
Right, plurally. Right, I've seen that. I've seen that document as well.
And you're absolutely right that you would have thought that film would have been Exhibit 1 in the McVeigh trial.
Well, that's one of the most important parts of this story, is that Judge Mache in Denver, this federal judge, oversaw two trials that aren't fit for Zimbabwe or Hosni Mubarak's Egypt, back when there was such a thing as that.
But anyway, they didn't produce those tapes. And so, and their excuse to the judge was, we looked real hard, Your Honor, but we just can't find those tapes. And the government takes the position, especially the FBI, that when anyone makes a request under the Freedom of Information Act for documents or records or materials that are embarrassing or harmful to the government, that all the FBI has to do is look for those records or documents or materials. It does not have to find and produce them. That's an incredible position to take, that all the law requires is that you look and you go wink and nod, we can't find anything.
Right.
And that's
what
this hearing is about on the 11th, is whether or not they have to do more than that, whether or not they have to go back and actually do a manual search and turn those tapes over.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we're all out of time. I know you got to go to court, and I got more interviews, but I really appreciate your time. Everybody's Jesse Trenadue. Look at KennethTrenadue.com. Search for James Ridgway. Wrote a great piece at Mother Jones. And just add PDF to your search and see what you find. Thanks very much, Jesse.
Thank you.